panel, she suddenly recoiled. "Oh, gross!"
"What?" asked Kincaid.
"I think..." The boy had another large bite wound, raw and weeping, and filled with what looked like white rice. And then the rice moved. "I think they're maggots."
"Really?"
Kincaid took a long look and then nodded.
"Excellent."
"Excellent?" Alex goggled at him. "What's good about maggots?"
"Because they eat the dead stuff and leave healthy tissue behind," said Kincaid. "See the margins there? That's all viable tissue. Alex, see if you can scoop a couple dozen of those little guys onto some gauze."
"Sure," she said faintly, not at all sure she wouldn't pass out. She couldn't get rid of the image of flies buzzing over the boy's wounds, landing and laying eggs. And then she thought, "Hey, wait a minute. You want some help?" asked Paul, although he sounded like he'd be just as happy if she refused. She did not disappoint. "No, I'm good."
"Oh, we are going to give you bad boys a regular feast," Kincaid said. "Warm you Maggie's right up."
"They look pretty warm to me," said Alex. "They're moving all over the place."
"He is the only person I know who would get excited over a bowl of maggots," Paul observed as he pumped up the blood pressure cuff again. 95/62. "I like the sound of that," Kincaid said. "Paul, get us another catalytic heater in here, and then see if you can scrounge us up a plastic container and an apple."
"You want to eat?" asked Alex. "Now?"
"Eventually." He winked at her over his mask. "Apples for the maggies. Old fishing trick. The maggies'll keep somewhere cool and dark for a couple weeks."
"We could start our own maggot farm," said Paul.
"That is a very good idea," said Kincaid. "We find somewhere warm enough. Flies'll die otherwise."
"I was joking." Paul rolled his eyes.
"Be right back, boss. I hope you and your maggies will be very happy." "Oh, we will," Kincaid said. "We will."
Great. Now she'd be babying maggots for the foreseeable future. Alex thought it would be a really long time before she looked at rice the same way again. Presuming, of course, she ever saw rice again.
"That's it," said Kincaid.
After peeling out of his gloves, he dragged the mask from his face and sighed.
"Wish I hadn't had to cut away so much tissue to find healthy muscle, but can't be helped. Between me and the maggots, though, those wounds might just granulate in. They won't be pretty, but if he's lucky, he won't lose the leg."
"Is he going to make it?" asked Alex. Kincaid's mouth set in a grimace.
"If things were even halfway normal, I'd say only 50-50. He's already arrested once, and he's septic. Fluids'll help, but we only got a couple more bags and no more antibiotic. If his blood pressure falls again, I got nothing left to give him."
"Maybe it won't," said Alex. "Maybe you got to him in time."
"Maybe. Be a damn shame, all this effort and risk for nothing. Just got to hope for the best."
He looked behind Alex.
"Greg, take this girl home before she passes out."
"Just waiting on you, Doc," said Greg from the door. Night had fallen hours before. Now she glanced at Ellie's watch and saw that Mickey said it was pushing 10. Untying her mask, Alex said, "Have you been there the whole time?" "All," Greg checked his pocket watch, 6 hours and 20 minutes.
"And it's way past my bedtime," said Kincaid.
He looked as if he was going to fall down, and when he dropped into a chair, he let out a long groan.
"Many more nights like this, and I'm going to be old before my time."
"You need to rest," Paul said.
A huge butterfly splotch stained the chest of his scrub top, and a sheen of sweat glistened on his ruddy scalp.
"We're not kids anymore."
"I heard that," said Kincaid.
"You should get some sleep," Alex said. She was dead tired, and she could smell herself. "I can watch him for a while. All I need to do is wash up a little bit." When Kincaid opened his mouth to protest, she said, "Come on. If something bad happens to you, we're screwed."
"She's got a point," said Paul.
Kincaid grumbled some more, but eventually gave in.
"I'll bed down here. You come get me in 4 hours," he said as Paul ushered him out. "Don't you forget."
"I won't," she said, and then after he was gone, "maybe." "You really do look beat," said Greg, who looked only marginally better than she felt. "You want company?"
"I'm fine," she said, and then ruined it by yawning. "Look on the bright side. You won't have to come get me in the morning. I'll bring you a change of clothes. Chances are Doc is going to let you knock off tomorrow, though." "Yeah, well..."
She glanced at their patient, whose color was only a little less white than his sheets. His dark hair looked artificial, like something penned in with a magic marker. Then she began to gather up soiled instruments. The plastic garbage bags were overflowing with soiled and bloodied gauze and the remnants of the boy's clothes.
"Let's see what happens. You should go home. I'm gone."
Greg tipped her a wave. "Just don't tell Chris."
"Now what," she thought as she began tidying up the treatment room, "would I tell Chris exactly? Oh, bad Greg left me all by my widow wonesome."
She had thought of Chris, too, and often. Not obsessively, not the way she had with Tom, but that had been different, hadn't it? She wasn't sure now what she'd felt with Tom, but they'd fought together, and he'd been hurt, maybe dying, and she'd been on a mission to save him. Yeah, like fail. She took the boy's blood pressure, noted his pulse, checked his IVs. Then, gathering up a tray of soiled instruments, she dumped them in alcohol before crossing the hall to retrieve their makeshift steam sterilizer. She carried the sterilizer outside, set it on a small propane stove, and lit the stove. While she waited for the steam to build, she washed the instruments, then placed them in the sterilizer. It would take about 20 minutes of steam to disinfect the instruments, heat being their only...
Heat. Heat.
Staring down at the tiny ring of blue flame, huddled in her scrubs and a thin yellow nurse's gown, she frowned. Something about heat had been bothering her for hours, but why? Kincaid's words came back. "Flies'll die in the cold." That was right. Flies died in the cold. Leave a dead anything out in the cold, and there would not be blowflies, not in winter. She had seen no flies in Honey's stable at all, not even 4 weeks ago. She'd seen more than a few dead bodies on the road, but no flies. And at the gas station, dead Ned.
"No flies," she murmured.
But the boy had maggots. Maggots could only come from flies, but if they'd found him in an abandoned barn, how had he stayed warm? What would have warmed up the barn enough so flies could live in winter? Okay, maybe the boy had started a fire. No, that couldn't be it. The boy was out cold when they brought him in. He was just the other side of dead. Hell, he had been dead. Which meant that someone else started the fire. Someone else kept the boy warm. There had been someone else, maybe more than one person. But Greg had said, "Found him by his lonesome in a barn." No, Greg. Not hardly. And they'd been nearer Oren. What were they doing there? They'd been on their way to Wisconsin, unless there'd been a change in plans. Hadn't Chris been up to Oren already? Right, that's where he'd gotten the books. So Chris had been there not long ago. Kincaid,
"Either you boys hurt, you boys get a name?"
If Kincaid was worried about that, he must have figured there was a fight. Getting a name, though, suggested not only other people, but a conversation. Or, oh my God, a trade? Something worse? Because Kincaid knew they hadn't just found this kid, they hadn't rescued him. They'd taken him. Chapter 62. Almost every kid she'd ever known, herself included, squirreled crap away in their pockets. Before she'd discovered Swiss Army knives, Alex's favorites had been rocks and chewing gum. She had no idea why, and her mother was always grousing about chewing gum that melted in the dryer. But there was nothing in the boy's pockets. What kid carried nothing? Alex stared in disbelief at the jumble of tattered clothing she'd retrieved from the trash. The stink was terrible, blood and pus and months' worth of dirt. The boy's name was penned into his sneakers, but too smeary from sweat and dirt for her to make out more than a J and an N, or maybe M. His flannel shirt had only one ripped pocket, and his jeans pockets were riddled with holes. She picked up a limp tongue of the boy's olive-green jacket in one gloved hand. The jacket had faux fur along the hood, and a sagging, quilted, blaze-orange zip-in lining. She hefted the jacket. Couldn't tell a thing from the weight, but that was the beauty of a zippered lining. Since coming to rule, she'd certainly used hers to sneak supplies for her great escape. So she unzipped and then pulled the lining completely from the jacket. Something metallic chinked to the floor. When she saw what it was, she clapped a hand to her mouth to stifle the scream. Not a knife. Not a gun. Her whistle. Chapter 63. She did not wake Kincaid. Instead, dry-eyed, she huddled by the boy, trying to will him back to consciousness. When that didn't work, she checked his blood pressure, fiddled with his IVs, listened to his too rapid heart, and felt his fingertips, which were cold. That, she knew, was bad, and she might have to get Kincaid soon, but not quite yet. All she needed were a few minutes alone with the boy, if he would just wake up. She'd slipped the whistle around her neck and tucked it under her scrubs, and now she touched it just to make sure it was still there. Of course it was. She was not dreaming. This wasn't like her parents slipping away into the night. This was real and tangible, and she ought to be able to put this together. All the pieces were there, she knew. She just didn't know how they fit together. Think. They'd left the ranger station on November 10th. Ellie had been taken the very next day, on the 11th. By Harlan's estimate, he'd last laid eyes on her a week or 10 days after that. Harlan had been banished from rule before Thanksgiving, so she couldn't ask him. But hadn't he said that they'd been attacked south of rule? She thought that was right. But the boy had come from Orin, which was northwest and over 50 miles away. That meant one of two things. Either Ellie had made it to Orin, or someone else had taken the whistle from her, maybe while she was still down south, and then found his or her way to Orin. Either the boy had actually seen Ellie and she had given him the whistle, or someone else had. Any way you cut it, someone had laid eyes on Ellie, maybe as recently as 6 weeks ago, when Chris had returned from Orin with books and those sunglasses. And Lena... angry, sullen, furious Lena was from Orin, and she tried to get back. Why? Because there were other people there? Yes, Lena had brothers who might still be alive. So, another enclave of survivors? Had to be. An image of Lena spitting something at Chris and then grabbing him, flinging herself into his arms. And Chris, it's not what you think. Well, she knew that already, didn't she? Alex had tasted the truth in his lips, felt it in their embrace, knew it from his scent. So if not that, if this was not about Lena and Chris as a couple, then what? She went over the sequence again and recognized now not only anger but desperation in Lena's body language. Lena had been frantic about something. But what? What could Chris possibly be in a position to do? Oh, my God! Alex gasped as the pieces clicked into place, the solution to a puzzle she'd only now realized had been there from the start. No, not desperate over what, desperate over whom. Alex thought it might work like this. Going on patrol must have more than one meaning. There was patrol, as in patrolling their perimeter, keeping out all kinds of bad guys. But there was also riding out of rule in search of supplies, meaning that they would almost certainly run into other survivors. There were raiders, so she knew there were other enclaves, doubtless many other rules. She'd been the one to suggest that they band together. Chris had dismissed that, saying that she didn't understand. But what if the men of rule were not, in fact, the armies of light at all, but those of darkness? Now that she allowed herself the thought, she realized its logic. Of course, the men of rule must raid other settlements. Look what happened in New Orleans after Katrina, in Baghdad when the troops invaded, or in the days when you could go to a grocery store right before a big old storm, a blizzard, say. The shelves got cleaned out in a heartbeat, People fought over bottled water in the aisles and slugged each other in the checkout lines. People stole. They looted. Sometimes they killed to get what they wanted. Things were a little different now, but maybe not by much. A lot of people were dead, not young enough to be spared and not old enough either. But it was a safe bet that the changed weren't heading out for a loaf of Wonder Bread. That left an awful lot of people, and maybe a fair number of spared, wandering around looking for the basics of survival. Warmth, water, food, shelter. She just bet those stores got cleaned out pretty quick. Hell, she'd seen enough on the road herself to realize this was true. She'd found a lot of bodies, but no food. So why did she ever swallow that Chris or Peter or any of the other patrols just happened to come upon a nice little grocery store somewhere that no one had thought to check out? Because she'd wanted to believe them. No, that wasn't quite right. She couldn't afford not to. She just hadn't wanted to think, period, because she was grateful to be safe and warm and fed and protected. But if they, she, had food and medicine, someone else went without. That was the way the world, brave and new or not, worked. So, you're Chris or Peter, armed to the teeth, and you raid and take what you need. But way back, Marjorie had said that towns let in people with kids, because kids were valuable. So what if you're carrying out a special mandate, following an order that only a few select people know? Jess had said it, following orders doesn't make you a man. So what if the orders were to find the spared? And not just that. Maybe the new rule was to find and then bring the spared back, whatever it takes, and kill anyone who stands in your way. Chapter 64. An hour later, the boy's blood pressure fell. Alex woke Kincaid. They pushed fluids, and Kincaid used the last of the dopamine to try and bring the boy's pressure back up. By the end, the boy's face was so swollen he looked like one of those good luck Buddhas. He died well before dawn, and never once opened his eyes. Chapter 65. She had to get out, Chris or no Chris. Whatever was happening between them didn't matter. She had to get out. Greg said that the others were a day behind. That meant that Chris and Peter would be back very soon. She had to get out before Chris returned, though she wasn't exactly clear on why that was so important. Remembering that sudden heat and their hunger for each other made her stomach fluttery with anxiety. Would she lose her nerve if she saw him again? No, that was crazy. She was crazy if she didn't take the chance and run now. Whatever was happening between them, well, she wasn't sure what it was, and she didn't want to find out. Run! Kincaid was done in and not thinking straight, or he'd never have agreed to let her take his horse back to town alone. Dawn was 2 hours away yet, and the night was still heavy and deeply cold, with a green thumbnail of a moon. As she left the hospice, she gave a cheerful wave to the guard hunkered in a puff of polar-weight sleeping bag inside the lobby's double doors. The guard, a retired miner not as debilitated and old as his sicker friends, hollered something she didn't hear, but that she thought might be, "See you later." "You bet!" she shouted back, thinking, "Not bloody likely." If there was a time to go, it was now, before Chris and the others made it back. The guards would still change over at 7, but that shouldn't be a problem. Kincaid's horse was much larger and stronger than Honey, and she thought that this horse was probably pretty fast. But she had to be smart. Galloping out of town with nothing was just flat-out dumb, and she needed to gather up what she could. She touched her jacket, felt the knot of the jiggly saw she'd liberated right before she got Kincaid, and the slender line of a heavy-duty scalpel. Unless she planned on strangling someone, the jiggly wasn't much of a weapon, but you could take off someone's nose with the scalpel. She still had the boot knife. Kincaid had a gun, but it was in his office. Where could she go right now to find another? Nowhere. She wasn't about to try breaking into the jail, and she knew only a limited number of streets in Rule, and where a few people lived. Come to think of it, she didn't know where Chris lived either, and that was a shame, because she knew he was gone. Greg said all the guys had a couple of guns, so no telling what Chris had at his place. Well, no use worrying about what she couldn't change. Riding at night was not as hard as she thought it might be. The snow shimmered like a silver ribbon, and the light ghosted through the forest well enough that she could make out individual trees. She'd have to be careful, though. No telling what was under the snow. Fallen trees, tangles of brambles. The last thing she needed was a horse with a broken leg. The southwest corner was her best option. Greg had said there were not as many guards, although Sarah said there were guards in the woods, some in the trees. Yes, but she had an advantage. She ought to be able to smell the guards and avoid them. If they had dogs, she might be in trouble, but she couldn't think how a dog would be of any use in a tree stand. Yeah, but then maybe she shouldn't bring the horse. A horse made a lot of noise, and this night was very quiet, no gunfire at all. Even raiders didn't want to freeze their asses off. There would be the change, though, and they weren't stupid. Jaeger could call them beasts all he wanted, but they knew what clothes were for. They'd be out there. She wondered if they'd learned about fire yet. Sure, why not? Jim, Tom's friend, remembered how to evade, and that girl at the gas station had a club. And if one of them figured out how to use a gun... Stop. You're overthinking it. One disaster at a time. When she turned into the village square, there were more men, and they all gave her a very long look as she passed. She screwed on the cheerful, chipper, just-minding-my-business look, and kept moving. Hold up there a sec. Shit. For a split second, she thought about kicking the horse to a wild gallop, but she pulled up and waited as another rider came alongside. He was squat, with arms like Popeye and no neck. She knew him, had seen him around the village hall, but couldn't dredge up a name. "You shouldn't be out alone," he said. He even sounded a little bit like Popeye. "That's Doc's horse."
"Yeah, but don't tell anyone, please." She gave what she hoped was a tired, grateful smile. "Doc let me take him. We've been up all night, and I just needed to get out of there."
It helped that this was true.
"That boy they found up by Orin?"
He gave her a one-eyed Popeye squint.
"Yep, heard about that. How's he doing?"
"He's dead."
She was so tired that her eyes began to well, and then she was crying for real.
"We were up all night. It was pretty bad."
"Hey, wow, it's okay."
He tried giving her an awkward pat on the shoulder, but didn't seem to want to touch her and only ended up patting air.
"You're a good kid. It's okay. You're just all done in."
"I'm really tired," she said, backhanding tears from her cheeks. "I just need to lie down, I think."
"Sure, sure."
He pulled up in his saddle, looked over his shoulder, and then back at her.
"Look, I'd take you home myself, but I gotta head out, meet up with the guys coming back. You going to be okay going by yourself the rest of the way?"
"Yeah," she said,
and snuffled. She used her jacket to wipe her nose.
"I'm okay. I should sleep."
"Yeah, that's a good idea. You do that."
Then he wheeled around and let her go on her way. Hurrying back to Jess's, she considered the problem of Lena. Lena was the only person she knew who'd gotten anywhere close to leaving Rule, and Lena was also from Orin. She would know the quickest way and what they ought to avoid. Hell, for all she knew, that dead boy might be related to Lena somehow. But taking Lena, even trying to talk to her, made her queasy. Even if she hadn't seen her with Chris, and Lena had avoided her since, Alex didn't know her well enough. What she did know of Lena, she really, really didn't like. The last thing she needed was someone along she'd rather kill than have watching her back, and there was the little problem of trying to sneak back into the house, which was a complete non-starter.
"Ghost."
A small moan pushed out in a steamy cloud. She would have to leave Ghost behind. The thought made her heart knot. There had to be a way to retrieve her dog. It was so unfair. Why was she always losing? She pulled in a breath.
Oh, shit, shit. The ashes. The ashes were upstairs in their case on the desk in her bedroom. No way to get at them. No way to take them. No, 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 not again, not again, not again. Mom. Her throat convulsed, and then she was crying again, only soundlessly, like a very small child. Dad. Daddy.
She'd completely forgotten about the stupid guard. Nathan's dog fawned over Alex like a long-lost relative. She gave the same story to Nathan about Kincaid, then said she wanted to take the horse down to the garage at the end of the cul-de-sac where she stabled Honey. If he suspected anything, Nathan didn't give any indication. He just dragged off his dog and waved her on her way. As a precaution, she crossed the street, hugging the sidewalk where the snow was deep enough to muffle the sound of the Appaloosa's hooves. Jess's house looked quiet enough, curtains drawn tight. All the bedrooms were at the back anyway. No one would be up quite yet, not even Jess. Honey nickered when she led the Appaloosa into the garage.
"I'm glad to see you too," she whispered, stroking Honey's nose. "But you can't come, girl."
Climbing a stack of boxes, she reached up, patted around until she found the feed bag, and then pulled it down from the ceiling joists. Her stash was miserably small, and she hadn't managed to find any food other than peanut butter and a few energy bars and 4 petrified rolls she'd wrapped in napkins and snuck out of the kitchen the week before. She scooped some oats into saddlebags, threw the bags behind the cantle, then tied them off. Then her eye fell on a wooden dowel protruding from a bale of hay, and she felt a surge of elation. Yes! She twisted out the hay hook. The point was wicked, and the hook itself was high grade. She could smell it, white and icy, the cold rolled steel as thick as her thumb. The white, clean smell of the steel was nearly overpowering, and... white?
Wait, she thought. That's not right. Steel doesn't smell white. Steel smells like metal. Steel doesn't smell like glare white ice.
Only one thing, one person, smelled like that. She wouldn't go back without a fight. Her fingers curled around the hook's wooden dowel. No way, no way she was going back. Fight. She turned, hay hook in hand, thinking, fight, fight.
Well, said Jess. She racked her shotgun. It's about time.
Chapter 66.
Why, asked Alex, are you helping me?
I've been trying to help you all along, girl, said Jess.
Beneath her parka, she still wore a white flannel nightgown, but her hood was thrown back and her hair was loose, flowing over her shoulders in a river of steel. She wore her shotgun, a Remington, slung over her back in a cross-carry.
You had to come to this yourself. Besides, I had to make sure that...
She broke off as Nathan slid out of the darkness with 2 horses.
Well?
Maybe 15 minutes, Jess.
Not now, Vi. Heel!
Nathan rapped at his dog, which had spurted over to greet Alex. Nathan jerked his head to the left.
They're coming. We going to do this? We gotta do it now.
15 minutes before what? Who's coming?
Asked Alex.
All right, then. Jess jerked her head at Alex. Come on. Bring Matt's horse. We don't have much time.
15 minutes before what?
Alex asked again as she led the horse out of the makeshift stable. She saw that the night was bleeding away. The sky was still a deep cobalt directly overhead, but fading to slate fast. It would be dawn in another half hour, maybe less.
You'll need this.
Jess handed over a medium-sized backpack. A pair of lightweight tub snowshoes was lashed to the pack.
Supplies, enough to last 2 weeks. Clothes from your room, and a nice sweater. I'm sorry, I couldn't risk a larger pack or a sleeping bag, but there's an emergency blanket in there, a plastic tarp, waterproof matches, a knife, and a flint.
Thank you, said Alex.
She unzipped the backpack to peer inside. If Jess had been in her room, maybe she'd taken the case.
But no, she saw at a glance that her parents weren't there. She'd actually already known that. The pack was too light.
Zipping the pack, hefting it to her shoulders, she looked up to find Jess studying her. "Best you shake the dust off your sandals, girl," Jess said. "The past is past." She didn't ask Jess how she'd known. It was a moot point anyway.
"I could use a gun. That Remington would be nice."
Jess shook her head. "That I cannot do. You won't need it anyway."
"How do you figure?"
"Trust me." That Alex did not. But did she have other options? What would happen if she refused to go? Would Jess shoot her?
"Why can't I have a gun?"
Alex asked. "I'm no threat to you. I want to leave." When Jess didn't reply, Alex persisted.
"You know what it's like out there, Jess. I'll go, but give me a fighting chance."
Jess studied her for a long moment, then said to Nathan, "Give her your rifle." Nathan's eyes widened. "Jess, I'm not sure, but I am." Turning, Jess boosted herself onto her horse. "Give her the rifle." Nathan's jaw tightened, and for a second Alex thought he would refuse, but then he thumbed off his carrying strap. "You know how to use a bolt action?" he asked Alex.
"Yes,"
she said, trying to hide her elation. The rifle was a scoped Browning X-bolt with a stainless steel barrel and dark walnut stock, a very good weapon.
"What's the pull?"
She couldn't tell if Nathan was contemptuous or amused. "Medium. 3.5 pounds, no take-up or creep. You got a detachable box mag here." He unlocked the floor plate and swung it open. "Holds 5 270 magnum shorts, and there's one in the chamber now, so you're loaded for bear. Safety's here on the tang, and there's a separate unlocking button where the bolt and the body meet up, so you can open the rifle on safe and unload, okay? She's a real good gun." That was an understatement. Not only did she have a rifle and a scope, a magnum short meant higher velocity and more power for the same amount of bang. She slung the rifle to a cross-carry, then tucked a box of cartridges Nathan handed over into her parka pocket and zipped that.
"Thank you,"
she said to them both. "Depending on what you find, you may not have cause to thank us," Jess said. Her scent had not changed, but that didn't mean much. Alex thought Jess was as good at hiding as Chris. Better, actually. In the months that she'd lived in Jess's house, Jess had remained a cipher, but the rifle convinced her.
"Jess wants me gone," she thought. "But why now?"
As if she'd read her thoughts, Jess said, "Now or never, girl. This is a one-time offer." Alex hopped onto the Appaloosa's back without another word and followed Nathan, already plowing into the woods at the end of the cul-de-sac. In 2 minutes, the three of them were deep into the woods, and Alex could no longer see any houses at all. "Now listen very carefully," Jess said. They were moving fast, the horses high-stepping through the snow. "The zone in this direction extends for 2 miles. After that, there are no guards."
No more guards?
And Kincaid had implied that the zone went on for 5 miles, not 2. Unless there was something different about the terrain. "How are we going to get—"
"Hold your tongue and listen. We will get you through, but once we reach the edge of the zone, I can no longer help you, and I can't send anyone with you either. The trail is plain as day. A mile further on, the trail forks, and from there, you'll have to go on foot."
"Why?" Ducking beneath a low-hanging branch, Jess flashed a look of impatience. "The trail's only a footpath, and too narrow for the horse. You want to go left, not right. You understand? Right will loop you back to Rule. So you must dismount and send the horse back. It will find its way." With no horse and no skis, slogging through snow in the woods, even with the snowshoes, would be rough.
"How long before I hit anything like a road?"
10 miles. From there, you can go anywhere you want. There's a map in the zipper pocket of the backpack. But remember, take the left fork, you understand?" She nodded.
"But why are you helping me? Why me and not Lena?"
"Peter wanted Lena," said Jess, kicking her horse to a fast trot. "But Peter isn't the one who has to decide." Alex urged her horse after.
"Decide? Decide what?"
"Whether to break the rules or not." Then she got it.
"This is about Chris."
"Let's just say I'm taking advantage of an opportunity to speed things up a bit," said Jess. You had to be ready, too. Now you are.
Ready for what?
For the same mission that led Isaac to sacrifice. Abraham was called by God to choose, and he chose righteousness. In the end, he was rewarded, and Isaac was saved.
Great. A Bible story. Just what she needed. That doesn't make any sense. That was a test.
And so is this, said Jess. Christopher cares for you. He wants you. He's chosen, whether he knows it or not. She felt the flush start in her neck.
I don't know about that.
Young lady, I may be old, but I'm not senile. Her mouth curled. Much. I heard it in his voice. I hear it in yours.
You can't hear something like that, Alex said,
then remembered what Kincaid had said.
Hearing like a bat, but with nuance.
And she remembered all those times she'd caught Jess looking at her, through windows, across a crowd.
Looking because she'd heard every word, even ones Alex barely gave voice to. Jess was an awakened. Chapter 67
They were well into the woods now. Nathan's dog bounded alongside, surging through the snow. It was very cold, but there was no wind. The air was gray and still as the trees pulled together out of the shadows and into the coming dawn. Alex caught just a whiff of wood smoke from somewhere far ahead. That and Nathan's sweat and the dog and Jess, immutable, as regal as a queen on her horse.
Nathan.
Alex's eyes narrowed. The guard was clearly following Jess's orders. Did that mean there were other people in Rule willing to do the same? If so, then Jess didn't need Chris to break any rules. She was doing it herself already, wasn't she? Unless there was a limit to how much she could do, how many people were willing to follow. Jess and Kincaid were tight. They were awakened, just like the Rev. But only Chris was a Jaeger. Well, not quite. His last name was Prentice, so that meant that Chris's mother had Jaeger blood, but she'd run away. Still, in Rule, that might count for a lot. Pitting Chris against his grandfather might be the only way for things to change. But what things? Turning away refugees? Doling out girls? What was Jess after? What did she want done that only Chris could do? Was challenging Jaeger such a risk? Maybe so. Jess clearly thought so. And Chris had always balked, maybe because that meant challenging Peter, too. And Peter was an Ernst, one of the five families. So for Chris to challenge his grandfather and Peter, he would have to want something badly enough to risk everything. If Jess was right, and Chris wanted Alex, then she was the bait. Hell, she was the prize.
"Wait a minute," she said, pulling up on her reins. Kincaid's horse stomped to a halt. "You want Chris to come after me?"
"Of course," said Jess, but she might as well have said, "Duh." Wanting is sweet, and a person desperately wants what he cannot have. If Christopher wants you, he will have to fight for you.
"But you're using me," she said, trembling with a sudden blast of anger.
Beyond, she saw Nathan turn.
"How do I know this isn't just window dressing? Something to make me think I'm going to get away so it can't be faked?"
"You have a gun.
So do you."
"I'm not going to shoot you, Alex. You will have to trust me." "Jess," Nathan called. "Jess, we gotta go."
"Trust you?"
Alex's fist balled in fury. Beneath her legs, the Appaloosa reacted, snorting and prancing.
"Why should I? You're making it sound like this challenge is some big deal, like civil war or something."
"It is," Jess said. Yes, Kincaid had said factions, hadn't he? The Ernsts against the Jaegers? Or were there others? She remembered that extra chair, how unbalanced the council had seemed. Because there was someone else? A sixth family?
"What if Chris gets hurt? What if his grandfather—"
"We won't let that happen," said Jess. "I know you have no reason to trust me, but we won't." The image of Chris riding into town, finding out she was gone, stole her breath away. He would come after her, and God, in another time and place, she might even want that. If there are so many of you, why don't you do it, then? Why don't you break a few rules? Jess's voice was as icy as her scent. And what exactly would you call this, Alex?
Nathan.
Jess, this is rule, girl, and the best I can do. If there is to be change, a challenge, it must come from Chris, Jess said. If he wants to be a man and blood of my blood, he must be tested. Test everything, but hold fast to what is good. Blood of my blood, said Alex,
and then remembered what she had heard but not really understood. Jess had said it plain and simple.
I thank God my grandson was spared.
Not spared as in saved from seeing how the world had ended or seeing his mother die, but spared.
Jess was Chris's grandmother.
Did Chris know? She didn't think so.
He had never said. Nathan let out a shrill, warbling whistle, and Alex jumped in surprise. What is it? She asked.
There, said Jess, on the trail and in the trees. We're almost there. Alex looked. Maybe 300 feet farther on, there was movement on either side of the trail, and then she spotted 2 snow-white horses in the woods and their riders in camouflage white, with only the dark ovals of their faces to betray that they were there at all. A bit farther on, in the high-spreading branches of a large oak, a man, armed with a crossbow, nestled in a wooden tree stand.
All right, said Jess. Remember, at the fork, take the left. Someone shouted Alex's name, faint but unmistakable, and as she turned in her saddle, she knew. Chris, on night, charging down the trail, bulleting through the woods at a dead gallop. He was still just a little too far away for her to make out his face, but she heard him just the same.
Alex!
Chris screamed.
Alex, no! Stop! Stop!
Chapter 68.
Go! Jess shouted. When Alex hesitated, Jess swatted the Appaloosa's haunch.
Hiya! Go! Go!
Startled, the Appaloosa shied and then spurted down the trail, surging with a mighty heave of its legs, and then Jess was right there alongside, and they were hurtling toward the edge of the zone. Gasping, Alex had to fight not to pull back on the reins. If she did that, she would be thrown in an instant. Ahead, she saw Nathan's dog dance out of the way as Nathan's horse kicked off the trail and they thundered past.
Keep going!
Nathan shouted. He waved them on.
Go! Go! Alex!
Chris shouted, and now his panic was unmistakable.
Alex!
Go! Jess slashed the Appaloosa with her reins, whipping the animal to a frenzy, and now it was all Alex could do just to hold on. Hunching down in the saddle, she grabbed for the pommel, tightening her thighs around the horse's middle, feeling the horse's power jolt up her spine with every pounding step. She and Jess were dead even, their horses blazing through the woods. The trees were a blur, a flash of whippy branches that grabbed at her arms and her hair, and she felt the sting as one scored her cheek.
Alex!
Closer now. She risked a quick peek back, saw that Chris was chewing up the distance between them, saw that he was gaining, would catch them, catch her.
Alex, stop!
Let her through! Jess shouted, and then she gave the Appaloosa one final vicious cut of her reins. Kincaid's horse screamed, a braying screech, and then it rocketed through the snow, bearing down on the mounted guards, and then they were there and gone in a flash, and she was past them and still going. Streaking beneath the archer in his stand, she broke through, and then she was out of the zone, she was out of rule, she was out of reach and gone, and Chris... A shotgun boomed, a blast that sounded like the earth was breaking in two, and Alex just had time to think, God, no, Chris! With a high, bawling cry, Kincaid's horse reared. Alex shrieked and flung herself at the horse's neck, nodding her fists into its mane. The horse reared again, its neck popping back. It hit Alex's forehead, and for a dizzying moment she thought she would be thrown for sure. There was blood in her mouth, and her vision tilted as the horse stabbed down, but she held on. They were turned around now, the horse dancing beneath her, and she was looking back down the trail, back toward Rule. She saw the shotgun in Jess's
Jess's hands, saw that night was still rearing, saw that the guards had converged and were now wrestling Chris from his horse. Chris tumbled to the ground, but he was flailing, fighting them, clawing his way back to his feet. She saw one guard slip and fall, and then Chris was free, and he was churning through the snow, trying to get to her.
Alex!
He was close enough now that she could read his despair, and then she suddenly caught the keener edge of another scent she knew. Horror. He shouted,
"Please, Alex, you don't know what you're..."
Jess clubbed him with the Remington. The blow was short and precise and caught Chris behind his right ear. Chris dropped to the snow in mid-stride and was still.
"No!"
Alex cried. She tightened her knees, and the Appaloosa started back toward Rule.
"What do you do? Stop!"
Jess racked the Remington and pointed it at Alex. In the tree stand, the archer leveled his bow, his arrow ready to fly into her chest.
"Not another step!
But Chris will be fine!
Shake thyself of dust and loose thyself, O captive daughter of Zion! Go, Alex," said Jess, "and do not look back!"
She did as she was told.
Part 5. Monster. Chapter 69. 4 miles on, she was on foot, having dismounted and then slapped the Appaloosa's rump to send it on its way back. The horse hadn't seemed to need much convincing and cantered away toward Rule. The correct trail was marked with a blood-red kerchief, and was so narrow and twisting that she thought it had once been a deer path, something a hunter might follow to find game. In a way, it was like the footpath that had led her and Ellie, in what seemed like another century, to the river, and then to those dogs, and poor, crazy Jim, and finally to Tom, which made her wonder if she was doomed to spend the rest of her life blundering down one path after another, searching for God knows what. The snow was deep and heavy and sucked at her boots. Her thighs were starting to burn, and her head ached. Her mouth hurt from where she'd bitten her tongue. When she swallowed, she tasted old blood, and her body was sore and bruised and shaken from her mad, wild dash through the woods, like she'd been stuck in a blender while Jess hit frappe. A test. This was all a test for Chris. She was free, but Chris couldn't be, not until he broke the rules of Rule, whatever they were. Frankly, she thought that all of Jess's spouting was about as nutty as Jaeger's. Her eyes snagged on something blue protruding on a stick from the snow about 10 feet ahead to the right of the trail at the base of a spindly pine. The color was startling and very clear, like a daub of turquoise paint on a perfectly white canvas. At first, she thought it was an old nylon trailblaze, the kind hiking clubs tied around tree branches. But when she got closer, she saw that this something was the remains of a sleeve. And the stick was a bone. She went absolutely still. Her mind blanked. She froze in mid-step, and for a second she could only stare, waiting for the white grip of stunned horror squeezing her brain to let go. She thought the bone was an ulna. Not that it really mattered. The small bones of the hand and fingers were gone, so either the rest of the body was buried under the snow, or the arm had been dragged here by whatever scavenger had claimed it before stripping off the meat. "Okay, this is like the road. It's not like you haven't seen a body before. There are scavengers. You're outside of Rule's protection now, so of course you're going to find bodies. People drop dead in their tracks, remember?" She took a cautious sniff, but smelled nothing more than the forest. No wolves, no raccoons. The bone wasn't that old, and it was not as white as the snow, but it wasn't fresh either. "It's okay." Thumbing the rifle's carry strap, she checked the safety, and then she stripped off her glove and snaked her right hand to her back, her fingers slipping around the wooden dowel of the hay hook where it dangled from a belt loop. She had the rifle, the hay hook, a knife. She'd be She wasn't sure what she sensed first, the long furl of something obscenely pink hanging from an oak to her left, or the rot. The smell made the tiny hairs on her forearms stand on end. She knew the stink was dead meat, but not them, not the changed. But there were bodies here, a lot of them, and she knew that things would not be fine. The thing dangling from the tree was a body, but it was not human. The fur was completely gone, peeled from the flesh like a glove. The animal's muscles were intact, not so much as a scrap missing, which was very strange considering all that meat. And come to think of it, she listened over the thrum of her heart, no birds here, no crows, nothing. The thing hung from a noose like some weird imitation of a scarecrow. She recognized what it was from the shape of its head and the curve of its teeth. A wolf. There were more wolf bodies now, on either side of the trail, marking the way like flags down the avenue of a parade. In less than an eighth of a mile, she came to a small clearing, a circle where the snow was tamped down like a dinner plate, which was, when she stopped to think of it, pretty apt. Actually, if you didn't know about the bones, you'd have thought that the clothes had all gotten dumped out of several very large laundry bags. There was a jumble of mismatched shoes and tightly laced boots, several with splintered leg bones poking from stockinged feet that had rotted, that she could smell very easily, even in the cold, as if clawing away the laces had been just too much trouble. The clearing was a riot of color and deflated sacks of clothing filled with bones. She even spotted the black tarantula of a toupee and a silver wig of tight permed curls, a golden puddle of chain nestled in a swath of shimmery black fabric. "Because you can't eat the jewelry," she thought a little crazily. The ruby-red frames of a pair of sunglasses stared up from the snow, the right lens broken into a starburst. "You can't eat glasses." This wasn't just a clearing. It was a feeding ground. And maybe one of several, because now her numbed brain registered more color in the trees to her left, and then farther on to her right again. Each area was marked by more wolf carcasses as well. Her gaze crawled from the clearing back to the trail. Ahead, she saw a neat pyramid, a crude trailmaker maybe, the kind normally made of stones. Only these were not stones. They were heads.
No.
Some were leathery and very old, the eyes and noses and ears gone, and the tongues. Others were fresher, with nerves worming from their sockets and half-eaten lips clotted with frozen gore.
No.
A few weren't old at all, were nearly fresh, with blue tongues and noses only slightly gnawed, and eyelids that dropped sleepily. But no maggots, no flies. It was too cold. Hadn't she just learned that? She counted, her gaze slowly ticking from one ruined face to the next. The pyramid was 12 heads long, 7 deep at the base, and stood maybe 4 feet high.
No!
Her breath died in her chest. She went completely and utterly still.
No!
She couldn't tear her eyes away.
No! Please! It can't be him!
It took all her will to blink and then blink again, as if her mind was a camera and she could somehow unsnap that picture so the image she'd just captured would be erased. But no. Nothing changed. Harlan was there. Second row down, 3 heads from the left. She could never forget that face, or those teeth. Her stomach seized. A flood of incredibly vile, intensely bitter liquid rushed from her mouth to spatter and steam in the snow. Her knees unhinged, and then she was sagging, the rifle sinking into the snow as the vomit roared from her mouth. She threw up until her stomach was empty. And then she hung there, groveling in ruined snow, gasping, her nose full of the stink of her own vomit. And then a fresh wave rolled over her, a stench of something sick and dead that had sweltered and decayed beneath a hot summer sun. A bloom of black horror squeezed her lungs and choked off her breath, and she finally understood why Jess had talked about Isaac and sacrifice. Maybe they had been watching. Maybe they had even enjoyed what they saw. But more likely, they came here out of habit, hunters following the likely path of good game, knowing where to find their next meal. There were 5, 3 boys, 2 girls. They wore parkas and boots and gloves. One boy and one girl wore skins, the animal fur pulled down so their eyes peered from a wolf's face. And they all had weapons. One girl and 2 of the boys, including Wolf Boy, had rifles. The 3rd boy, maybe a middle schooler once, had a Beretta, which would be much easier for a young boy with small hands. The only one without a gun was Wolf Girl, who held a corn knife instead. The blade, very long and very sharp, was stained with rust spiders of dried blood. And there was one more thing, one last detail that made these kids so very different. These changed weren't clean, but they weren't filthy either. They looked, in fact, very well fed. The truth hit her like a hammer. Rule wasn't fighting them. Rule was feeding them.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Ashes by Ilse J. Bick. Copyright 2011 by Ilse J. Bick. Performed by Catherine Kellgren. Directed by Nikki Banks. Copyright in the audio recording 2011 by Audible Incorporated, all rights reserved. Published by Brilliance Audio. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. And please visit Audible at www.audible.com to discover over 50,000 titles available for download to the Apple iPod, BlackBerry, and hundreds of other MP3 players and mobile devices. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.